A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's been thinking about Yiddish again, and he's not neutral about it. He says it's a language he's never really understood, and that in Israel it's polarizing. He leans toward the negative view. To him, Yiddish is the product of diaspora, persecution, suffering. He knows other people see it as a part of Jewish experience that retains value even now that there's a state of Israel. And he notes that position is maybe less complicated among Jewish groups who don't identify as Zionist. Then he asks the questions he actually once answered. 1. How did Yiddish emerge within its very specific ethno-religious background? 2. Which groups today aren't only still speaking it, but investing in its future as an organized language? And buried in, there's a third thing. Did Yiddish ever exist as a pidgin before it became a language, or not?
That buried question is the one I want to start with, because it's the kind of thing people assume they know the answer to and mostly don't. Yiddish isn't a pidgin. It never was. But the fact that Daniel asks tells you something real about how the language looks from the outside.
It looks like German wearing a Hebrew coat.
Right, and if that's your picture, then pidgin seems like a reasonable guess. A bunch of vocabulary bolted onto someone else's grammar. But that's not what happened. Yiddish has a full Germanic grammar. Verb second word order, a case system in the older forms, productive morphology, the whole machine. Pidgins are reduced. They have to be because they emerge fast, between adults who need a trade language and don't share one. Yiddish wasn't reduced. It was built.
So the question isn't why it looks like a pidgin, it's why it doesn't.
And the answer is in how it emerged. Around the 9th or 10th century, Jewish communities in the Rhineland, Speyer, Worms, Mainz, the old Shuam cities, were speaking a Romance-based language, Loez, Judeo-French, essentially. They'd come up from France and Italy, and at some point they shifted to the local German of their Christian neighbors. But they didn't just adopt it, they carried their own lexical world into it.
The Hebrew Aramaic layer.
For religious, legal, communal concepts, things that had no German equivalent because they belonged to Jewish practice. And there was a Romance residue from Loez that stuck around in odd places. Then later, when Yiddish-speaking Jews moved east into Poland-Lithuania, a Slavic layer came in. So you have four components: Germanic base, Hebrew, Aramaic, Romance, Slavic. Max Weinreich's framework. He called Yiddish a fusion language.
It's not just a word for mixture. It's a claim about how the language is organized. Each component has a job.
Yes. The Germanic component is the skeleton, the grammar, the basic vocabulary. The Hebrew-Aramaic component is the Jewish component, and it's not evenly distributed. It spikes in religious context, in legal discussion, in anything touching communal life. The Slavic component is strongest in the Eastern dialects, in everyday vocabulary, in aspectual stuff. The Romance layer is the oldest and thinnest, a few dozen words, some of them hiding in plain sight.
Give me one.
The Yiddish word for praying, davenin. There's a decent case it's Romance, possibly from the same root as the Latin divinus. Not certain, but it's a candidate. Or benchnen, to bless, which is clearly from Latin benedicere. That's the Romance layer peeking through.
So the language encodes its own migration history. You can read the route from the Rhineland to Poland in the vocabulary.
That's exactly what Weinreich argued. The dialects map onto the communal boundaries and migration routes of Ashkenazi Jewry. Western Yiddish, which was closer to German, largely died out by the 19th and 20th centuries. Eastern Yiddish is what became the basis of the modern standard. And the standard itself was a project. YIVO, the research institute, did the standardization work in Vilna in the 20s and 30s.
Vilna, which was itself a center of Yiddish civilization. The Jerusalem of Lithuania, they called it.
And YIVO was the institutional brain of that civilization. Weinreich was there. His History of the Yiddish Language is the canonical text. The four-component model comes out of that work.
So, the ethno-religious shaping. Let's sit with that, because it's Daniel's first question, and it's the part people skip. Yiddish wasn't just a language Jews happened to speak. It was a language that encoded Jewish life in its vocabulary.
Right. The Hebrew-Aramaic component isn't decorative. It's the language of the law, the liturgy, the communal calendar. When you talk about Shabbos, about Kashrus, about a Din Torah, you're using the Jewish component. When you talk about buying potatoes, you're using the Germanic or Slavic component. The language itself marks the boundary between sacred and everyday.
Which is a very specific ethno-religious situation. A minority community maintaining distinctiveness while embedded in the majority language environment. The language is doing boundary work constantly.
And that's why it became a full language rather than a pidgin. A pidgin is what happens when two groups need to trade. Yiddish is what happens when a community needs to live, to pray, to argue, to raise children, to write letters, to tell jokes. That requires the full grammatical apparatus. You can't run a civilization on a reduced grammar.
There's a line from Weinreich I'm trying to remember. Something about a language being a dialect with an army and a navy. No, that's someone else. But Weinreich had a version of it about Yiddish specifically.
The famous quip, a language is a dialect with an army and a navy, that's usually attributed to Max Weinreich, though he was quoting someone else. A student in one of his classes. The point was that the difference between a language and a dialect is often political, not linguistic.
And Yiddish spent most of its history without the army or the navy, which is why people kept calling it a dialect, a jargon, a corrupted German. The name itself, Yiddish, just means Jewish. It was the Jewish tongue, as opposed to the Christian tongue.
And that naming is itself a political act. Calling it a dialect of German was a way of denying its status, saying it wasn't a real language. The Nazis did this, but they were late to the party. German scholars had been doing it for centuries.
So, the linguistic facts are clear. Yiddish is a Germanic language with a four-component structure, written in the Hebrew alphabet, developed in the Rhineland around 1,000 years ago, carried east, standardized in Vilna. Not a pidgin, a fusion language. And the fusion is precisely what you'd expect from the ethno-religious situation, a community that needed to speak the local language and also needed to remain itself.
And that's the setup for the second part of Daniel's question, because here's where it gets charged. The same features that made Yiddish a language, the boundary maintenance, the marking of Jewish distinctiveness, are the features that made it a target in the Zionist project.
Right. So let's talk about why this language became a political argument in Israel.
The negative view that Daniel describes has a real history behind it. The early Zionist movement had a doctrine, Shlilat HaGalut, the negation of the diaspora. The idea was that diaspora existence wasn't just unfortunate but fundamentally deformed. The Jew in exile was passive, weak, at the mercy of others. The state of Israel was meant to end that condition, and Yiddish was the language of the condition.
The language of the shtetl, of the ghetto, of the people who couldn't defend themselves.
Hebrew was revived precisely to replace it. Hebrew was the language of sovereignty, of the ancient homeland, of the Bible. Yiddish was the language of exile. So the two languages got mapped onto a political opposition. Hebrew meant the future. Yiddish meant the past, and the past was something to be escaped.
And this wasn't just rhetoric. There were concrete episodes. The 1913 language war in Palestine. The fight over whether the Technion would teach in German or Hebrew. Yiddish was in the mix too. The Yishuv, the pre-state Jewish community, actively suppressed Yiddish in some contexts. There were Yiddish theaters that got pressured, Yiddish newspapers that struggled.
The suppression is real, and it's documented. But the story is more complicated than Zionism killed Yiddish. There's a historian, Rachele Rojansky, who wrote a book called Yiddish in Israel, A History, and her argument is that Yiddish didn't simply disappear. It persisted, adapted, and was actively used in theater, press, cultural institutions. The standard narrative flattens that out.
What's the mechanism she describes?
Yiddish speakers kept speaking. They read Yiddish newspapers. They went to Yiddish theater. They published Yiddish books. The state didn't ban it. It just didn't support it, and in some cases actively discouraged it. But the language had its own institutional life. It shrank, yes, but it didn't die.
And meanwhile, in a completely different part of the Jewish world, Yiddish was doing something else entirely. The Haredi communities.
This is the part that complicates Daniel's view even further. For the Haredim, the ultra-Orthodox, Yiddish isn't a relic, it's a living vernacular. In Jerusalem, in B'nai Brak, in New York, in London, Children grow up speaking it. It's the language of the home, the street, the yeshiva.
And it's doing boundary work again. The same thing it did in the Rhineland.
Deliberately. For Haredi communities, Yiddish is a way of marking separation from secular Hebrew-speaking society. Hebrew is the language of the state, of the army, of the secular world. Yiddish is the language of the community. Speaking Yiddish is a statement about where your loyalties lie.
So the language that Zionism wanted to leave behind is now being maintained by the community most opposed to Zionism's secular vision. That's a remarkable reversal.
It's not exactly a reversal. The Haredi relationship to Zionism is complicated. Some are anti-Zionist, some are non-Zionist, some are pragmatic. But the point stands. Yiddish is a live language in communities that don't see the diaspora as a condition to be negated. For them, diaspora existence is a legitimate form of Jewish life, and Yiddish is its natural language.
Which connects to Daniel's observation that the Yiddish retains value. Position is less complicated among non-Zionist groups. If you don't think the diaspora was a mistake, then the language of the diaspora isn't a problem to be solved. It's just the language.
And that's the thing I want to push on. The negative view treats Yiddish as a symbol of suffering, and it was. The people who spoke Yiddish suffered enormously, but the language itself wasn't the suffering. It was the language in which people lived full lives, loved, argued, raised children, wrote poetry, told jokes. The suffering happened to them. The language was theirs.
There's a distinction between a language of a people and a symbol in a political argument. Yiddish keeps getting drafted into arguments about diaspora and sovereignty, and the arguments distort it.
Daniel's view is one side of a real debate. I don't think it's wrong to feel the weight of the suffering, but the linguistic record doesn't support treating Yiddish as merely a product of persecution. It was a product of creativity, of adaptation, of a community building a complete world in words.
I want to pause on that word, creativity, for a second, because I think it's the part that gets lost. When you say Yiddish was a product of creativity, what does that actually mean in practice? What did Yiddish speakers do with a language that was new?
Well, look at the literature. The modern Yiddish literary tradition, Sholem Aleichem, I.L. Peretz, Mendeli Mocher's Forum, they built a literary culture in a language that had been primarily oral for centuries. They had to invent the literary register as they went. That's creative work on a massive scale. And then you have the theater. The Yiddish theater was a phenomenon. It wasn't just translating European plays, it was creating a whole dramatic idiom.
And the humor. We mentioned it before, but it's worth sitting with. Yiddish humor isn't just jokes in Yiddish, it's a specific rhetorical mode. The ironic shrug. The question answered with a question. The joke that's really a complaint, and a complaint that's really a joke. That's a linguistic achievement. You can't do that in a language you're just borrowing.
Right. And that's the thing about the pigeon question. A pigeon can't produce Sholem Aleichem. It can't produce the Yiddish theater. It can't produce the kind of humor that's so specific to the language that it doesn't translate cleanly. The humor is proof of the full linguistic apparatus. You need the whole grammar to be funny that way.
The linguistic facts and the cultural record point in the same direction. Yiddish wasn't a reduced thing. It was a full thing. And the full thing is what made it a threat.
Threat?
To the Zionist project. If the diaspora produced a full civilization, a language, a literature, a theater, a humor, then the negation of the diaspora is harder to sustain. You can't just say it was all suffering. There was something there worth keeping.
That's exactly why the suppression was so intense. It wasn't just about replacing one language with another. It was about discrediting the diaspora as a cultural project. If Yiddish was just a jargon, just a corrupted German, then losing it was no loss. But if it was a real language with a real literature, then losing it was a real loss. And the Zionist project didn't want to admit that loss.
The political argument was doing linguistic work. Calling Yiddish a dialect wasn't a neutral description. It was a way of making the loss feel less like a loss.
The people who spoke Yiddish knew this. They felt the insult. There are accounts of Yiddish writers in Israel being treated like museum pieces, like they were carrying around a dead thing, and they kept writing anyway. The Rojansky book documents this. The Yiddish press in Israel kept publishing for decades. The theater kept going. The language didn't cooperate with the narrative.
Now, let's get to the second question. Who's actually investing in Yiddish's future as an organized language?
The big institutional players are YIVO, which still exists and still does standardization and research. The Yiddish Book Center in Amherst, Massachusetts. They've digitized something like 11,000 Yiddish books, and they run translation programs, summer programs, a whole ecosystem. University programs. There are Yiddish chairs at several major universities. Yiddish theater is having a moment, especially in New York. And online, there's a whole scene. Duolingo has a Yiddish course, which sounds like a joke, but isn't. Tens of thousands of people have taken it.
Duolingo Yiddish. That's the clearest sign that something has shifted. The language of the shtetl is being learned by people who have no shtetl and no family connection to it.
That's the interesting part. Some of the people learning Yiddish are descendants of Yiddish speakers who want to recover something. But some are just people who find the language compelling. The literature, the music, the humor. Yiddish has a cultural gravity that pulls people in.
The humor is a big part of it. Yiddish humor is a whole genre. The timing, the irony, the shrug. It's a language that's very good at being funny about being unhappy.
Which is itself a diaspora adaptation. The humor is a survival mechanism, but it's also just good. It works even if you don't know the history.
The contemporary investment is real. It's institutional. It's digital. It's cultural. And it's not nostalgia. The Yiddish Book Center isn't a museum. It's a working library with a translation program and a summer institute. YIVO is still producing scholarship. The universities are still hiring Yiddish professors. This is a live project.
The question, and I think this is the open question, is what it's for. In the Haredi communities, it's for boundary maintenance. In the universities, it's for scholarship. In the online communities, it's for something else. Connection, maybe. Identity. Curiosity. The answer isn't settled.
The Israel polarization doesn't map cleanly onto the contemporary investment. The Haredi Yiddish speakers in Jerusalem aren't part of the Duolingo scene. The Yiddish Book Center isn't taking a position on Zionism. The language is moving in multiple directions at once.
Which is what living languages do.
That's the linguistic story and the political story. Let's bring in Hilbert, who has a story about this.
I sorted Yiddish books one summer, cataloger's assistant at a repository in a converted warehouse, not the big one in Massachusetts, smaller. We got donations, people cleaning out their parents' apartments, synagogues closing, estates. My job was to sort them by condition and dialect. I never learned to read a word of it. The rule was, no book gets thrown away, even water damaged, even mold. You put the moldy ones in a separate pile and you wear gloves, but you don't throw them out. The director said every one of these was somebody's life. They were heavier than I expected. Yiddish books are dense, small type, thin paper, but the weight. You'd pick up a prayer book and it'd feel like it had been read 1,000 times because it had. The pages were soft. I found a Yiddish translation of Sherlock Holmes once, A Study in Scarlet, and in the margin somebody had written a note arguing with the translator's choice of word for deduction, in Yiddish, I assume. I couldn't read it. But the handwriting was furious. The person was angry about this word choice. That's the thing. Daniel says Yiddish is the product of suffering. And yes, a lot of those books came from people who suffered, but the books weren't about suffering. They were about Sherlock Holmes and the right word for deduction, and somebody cared enough to write an angry note in the margin. People were living in Yiddish, not just dying in it.
The marginalia is the detail. A language is alive when people argue in it about word choice. That's not preservation, that's use.
The rule about not throwing books away. That's a kind of reverence, but it's also a recognition that the book is evidence. You can't replace a water-damaged prayer book. It's not the text that's irreplaceable. It's the object, the ware, the pressed flower, the receipt.
There were receipts, grocery lists, a pressed flower and a book of psalms. Once, a train ticket from Warsaw to Vilna, dated 1937. I put it back where I found it. It belonged there.
The train ticket. That's the diaspora in one object. But also, somebody was going somewhere. They had a reason to travel. Life was happening.
I keep thinking about the angry marginalia. Someone reading Sherlock Holmes in Yiddish and getting into an argument with the translator. That's not a person who thinks of their language as a product of suffering. That's a person who thinks of it as the language in which you argue about Sherlock Holmes.
The director said the angry notes were the best sign. A book with arguments in the margins means somebody was reading it properly.
That's the counterpoint to the symbolic view. The symbol flattens. The marginalia is specific. A particular person, a particular book, a particular word they disagreed with.
The weight. The books were heavier than expected. That's partly the paper, but it's also the density of use. A book that's been read 1,000 times carries the reading in it.
The prayer books were the heaviest, but you'd open one and see the thumb marks on the pages, the corners worn soft. Somebody held this book every day for 40 years. That's not a relic. That's a tool.
A tool. That's the word. A prayer book as a tool. It's not a sacred object in a glass case. It's something you use, something that wears down with use, something that shows the wear of the hand.
That's the thing the symbolic view misses. The negative view, Yiddish as the product of suffering, turns the language into a monument. But the language was never a monument. It was a tool. People used it to pray, to argue about Sherlock Holmes, to write grocery lists, to buy train tickets. The monument version is a distortion.
What does it mean that Yiddish is now being deliberately maintained in situations that aren't the situation that created it? Hardy communities, university programs, online communities. The language was born in a specific ethno-religious condition. Now it's living in conditions that are different, and the question of what it's for is still open.
The Israel polarization. Does it tell us more about Yiddish, or more about the arguments Israelis are having about diaspora and sovereignty? I think it's mostly the latter. Yiddish is the vehicle for an argument that's really about something else.
The contemporary investment isn't nostalgia. It's a live project. The question is what it's for. That's the thing to sit with.
Thanks to Hilbert Flumingtop for producing.
This has been My Weird Prompts. If you want to reach us, email us at show@myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from law. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.